Well, good morning. We're going to get started here in our study in Genesis. And we have left off talking about the gap theory of how people understand the creation account. That theory, remember, said that in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, there is a gap of time that was supposedly proposed so that it would allow for modern scientific claims about evolutionary processes in the earth. We noted that its most serious proponent was C.I. Schofield. So we have a Schofield Reference Bible. He talks about that. He actually had extensive teaching on that elsewhere. It also had to do with, you remember, they claimed that there was a group of angels that essentially trashed the earth in between Genesis 1 and 2, and that's what brought about all of the supposed geological formations destruction that we see today. Now, I'm going to talk about two other theories here this morning, wrong ones, I believe. But it's worth pausing just for a moment and asking the question, why did somebody like Schofield, who was a conservative, Bible-believing, Bible-preaching, he was Presbyterian, we'll give him grace on that, but other than that, I mean, he's a really great guy, right? Why would he believe that? And not just him, lots of others as well during this time period. Again, now, C.I. Schofield, he lived from 1843 to 1921. Now, you know, there's just certain periods in world history where there is massive amounts of change that happens. And if you think about 1843 to 1921, that is a really significant time period. He's in the United States. You tell me, what sort of things did he experience during that time period?
He was really influenced by Darwin when he was young.
Okay, Darwin comes on the scene. And he's really influential. There's one. What else do we have? What's that?
The dinosaur fossils.
Yeah. Got all these dinosaur fossils. I mean, we have archaeologists and we have, what's the other, that's not archaeology, what's the word?
Paleontologists.
Thank you. One of those ologists, right? Okay. You know, they're digging up stuff like crazy. You also have geologists, too, that are doing lots of specialized work during that time period. And there's all sorts of questions that are being brought up there. Yeah. You also have this, that we have the Industrial Revolution that takes place during that time period. Right? There is an explosion of progress. We're kind of, by the way, in another era of that since the age of the Internet, right? It's a new era. Of course, there's also sorts of wars and stuff. You think about, he was an American, you think about Civil War and you know, stuff like that, that he sees the World War I as well, you know, in his last years of his life. I mean, those are important events as well. But you think just about the Darwinian stuff, we're digging up fossils, geological questions, and industrial progress. The whole idea of an evolutionary model was just kind of natural for people to believe in. It felt like it made sense of the world as it was unfolding. And you're entering into what we would call also philosophically modernity during that time period. We're not in modernity anymore, but during that modern period, that's a proper term, modernity, I mean, people really thought that if you studied nature and the facts of nature, that you could arrive at truth. Now, did somebody like Schofield buy into all of that? No, he did not. He clearly did not, right? But it just made sense to think of some sort of evolutionary ideals that were brought into the Bible. And so that really comes into play. This is an uncomfortable fact, and I've talked about this at other times and other places, but it's a good one to emphasize it again, that our culture, whether we like it or not, puts immense amounts of both pressure, but also helps us to both see and not see things. J- just because of the cultural air that we breathe. Even more than that, whether we like it or not, even as Christians, philosophy, current philosophy, affects how we read and interpret things. Now, I actually don't think that's always a bad thing, but it's just a fact. And we have to remember that. So Mr. Schofield was influenced heavily by philosophy and culture that shaped how he read the Bible. Now, sometimes that's good. All right, for instance, if we were to rewind the clock, about 1,000 years ago, would there be any semblance of a class like this for the laity in the church? Shake your head no. There would not be. And it wasn't just because we couldn't do the printed page or you didn't have an educated pastor or teacher. Just the very idea that the average Joe, which is a very modern idea, right? That the average Joe could study and learn anything, that was not really in the cultural or philosophical air, right? Okay, so I think that was actually a bad thing in parts of the latter Middle Ages. It's much better now that we can have this kind of thing and everybody can be brought up in greater and greater amounts of truth. So culture and philosophy aren't always bad, but we need to recognize that they do shape our thinking and they do shape the way we read things. And Schofield was like that. He was influenced by that. So yes, influenced by Darwin, influenced by, you know, digging up the bones, geology, and the age of progress. That shaped a lot of what he's like. So that's just kind of a reminder for us, but also a warning as we think about these things. Now, I'm going to actually suggest in these other two wrong ways of reading Genesis that the same kinds of forces are at play. So we'll talk about here in a moment the day-age theory, and then we'll talk about the literary framework theory or literary hypothesis theory, and that sounds more complicated than it actually is. Those are really more modern ideas, and I think as well they're being influenced by culture and philosophy around us more than what the Scripture says. So moving on from the gap theory, let's talk about number two, the day-age theory. The day-age theory. Sometimes it's also known as the concordant theory as well. I threw out a name there. Derek Kidner is probably the most well-known proponent of this theory. So if you ever come across, IVP has a little series of commentaries on the Old and New Testament. It's the IVP Old Testament, New Testament series. We actually have a bunch of them in our church library. Sam, is that what you guys are using for? Are you using one of those IVP little? Is it like a black book for a black cover for Proverbs? Or are you using something else?
I don't know that it's IVP. I'm trying to remember the name of the author because I haven't had it for a couple months now.
Okay, sorry.
It is a small Genesis
or Proverbs, yeah.
Proverbs rather. Text. I can't think of the author. Yeah, I got it from Pastor Greg.
Okay, all right. Sorry to put you on the spot. All right, so not fair. All right, Kidner is, I think, the editor of that. He's now, I don't know if he's even alive anymore. If he is, he's getting up there in years. Largely a conservative Bible teacher. I've read many of his works, used some of his commentary stuff. It's really, really good in many, many places. But Kidner also was trying to merge supposed scientific discoveries with the Bible and trying to figure out how we could have some sort of evolutionary model that fit with the Bible. And he proposed, among others, he's just the most well-known, the day-age theory. And this theory, letter A, is based upon the possibility of translating the word day, which often comes up in the narrative creation, by a period longer than 24 hours. And thus it's possible that each day corresponds to geological eras. All right. Three texts are used to support this. All right, Psalm 90 and verse 4. For 1,000 years are in your eyes like yesterday. So the proposal is, that since you can use the word day metaphorically, that day doesn't have to mean a literal 24-hour day. It can mean an age or an era or an extended length of time. Or Isaiah 4:2. In that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious. All right. And then they would even point to things like Genesis 2:2. God rested on the seventh day. And they would say, well, that's obviously metaphorical in and of itself. So, I mean, God doesn't actually rest, right? He doesn't stop being God. His action is all keeps moving. So that must mean some sort of metaphor. And there's other texts they would use as well. Now, it's true that in Hebrew, which is the language that Genesis is written in, that the word day can have broad meanings. All right? By the way, that works in English. How many people have ever used the phrase, back in my day, or back in his day, or back in her day? Right? We understand that in English, that the word day has a lot of flexibility to it. That's a normal thing. Normal thing. Right? And the same is true in Hebrew. Okay? But there are clear markers at times that indicate when a day means an actual physical 24-hour day. All right? And in Genesis 1, there are clear markers that indicate this. So it says there was an evening and a morning. All right? All right, so if I said, you know, last week on a particular day, one morning, you're not thinking about, oh, back when PD, you know, he was a kid. Right? You have a specific marker that says for a specific period of time. There's an evening morning. That makes the broad sense very unlikely. In fact, in Hebrew, there is not a single other example, when the word day appears with numbers or statements like evening or morning, when the word day does not mean a 24-hour day. That's a really complex sentence. I need to simplify that. All right. But did you get the idea there? Could you follow it in spite of the wordiness of that? So you're not going to find anywhere in the Old Testament, in Hebrew, where you have like time markers like evening and morning, and the word day means something other than a literal 24-hour day. So Genesis 1 would have to be the only place in the whole of Hebrew literature where this is the case. It's actually a very, very weak argument. Number two, the correspondence of the text to the order of the appearance of animals given by scientists is not so obvious as it is claimed. So if you read through Genesis 1 and you see the order of creation, you find that trees are created before marine animals and birds before insects. In other words, how in the world did we have birds for millions of years before we had insects? All right? It doesn't make any sense. Similarly, the greatest difficulty is that you have the creation of the sun and the stars that come after that of the earth and the flora, that is the plant life. That doesn't make any sense either. This goes back to Augustine's claim back in the 4th century that he says the greatest miracle of creation is not that God could create it, but the fact that he could stretch it out over 6 days. Right? So how was it that you had all of these things created before the heavenly bodies? Answer, it's a miracle. The whole thing's a miracle. He spoke things into existence. Right? This theory doesn't satisfy either the scientific questions, nor does it satisfy the biblical questions. Largely today, This idea is not seen in vogue by teachers and preachers today, although you still will find it out there. And if you read commentaries, especially that stretch back from the 60s, 70s, into the 80s and 90s, you'll find this theory proposed. So you will run across it now and then. Let's spend a little bit more time on the literary framework or literary hypothesis theory. All right. Now, this theory is the most popular today among evangelicals who do not hold to a six-day creation model. And I want to bring this up again. I talked about this last week. In fact, I was just having a conversation with one of our church members this week saying, when I said that, you know, we are actually in the minority of churches today that would hold to a, you know, with pastors that would hold to a literal six-day creationism. That makes us in the minority, okay? Just admitting that. And this brother was just saying, yeah, you know, he was giving statistics and citing other relevant data from denominations that he's been a part of in the past and saying, yeah, this is absolutely true. We're in the minority on this. Well, today, this literary view is the most popular. And it's taught in lots of supposedly evangelical seminaries. And they are evangelical in many ways, but it's taught in many places. Now, there are two primary forms of this view, this literary view, although they are often found in combination. The first is that of artistic formulation. And here, the interpreter appeals to the supposed parallel triad of days in the 6 days and sees this as evidence of a poetic structure. And I've thrown a chart in here that's not original with me. You can find this in other places in various forms, but this is the idea. Is that if you look at Genesis 1-2, you have the phrases, the earth was without form and void. And so the idea in this literary framework is that God first formed the earth and the heavens on days 1, 2, and 3, and then God then filled them, he filled them in Genesis 1 and verse 2, on days 4, 5, and 6. Okay, so remember, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. So there's some sort of creative act by God. It's clear in the Bible that he creates this, you know, overall framework, structure, and then God shapes it and fills it. Okay, and so they would say that, look, there is this parallel between days 1, 2, and 3. Here's God continuing to form everything. And then days 4, 5, and 6, here's God filling what he has formed. Others, letter B, point to the artistic formulation by noting that Genesis 1 and 2 are two different accounts of the creation and thus indicate that Genesis is not trying to relay science or literal claims, but is artistically revealing what creation is about and how God is the creator and sovereign God. So others might even use this parallel triad idea, but then also say, well, you know, Genesis 1, you have the one creation account, and then Genesis 2 and verse 4, you have another creation account. That indicates that Moses isn't trying to teach us anything literal. He's setting up ideas about what God is like in his creative power. Because there's two different creation accounts, they would claim. You following this on the triad, right? So, or think about it this way. Here's an analogy, right? So, you have construction crews that come and build your house, right? And you have the first kind of set of people put up the big structure. Got a cough drop for me? Thank you. Am I going to gag on it?
I hope not.
Okay, good. It's Halls, so you know. Okay, that's what I was asking, because those are, I didn't want to be surprised. So they're good, but they're strong in their taste. So so you got construction crews, right? Construction crews. And they come, and the first kind of set, you know, you've got the people are going to dig the hole for your basement. You've got concrete that's poured, walls that are poured. The frame is put up, roof's put on, siding. All right, anybody who's been through a new build, this is pretty much what happens right away, right? So you've got the framework, and then you have all these specialty people who come in and fill the house. Plumbing, HVAC, flooring, you know, paint. I missed the drywall part in there, right? All that stuff. And then you have the people who fill it with the appliances, that kind of stuff. And so the claim here is that this indicates in these two halves of this triad, that's three, that there's a symmetry, and this would give us an artistic or poetic way of understanding Genesis 1. God sets up the frame, and then he fills it. Right? So that's one way, artistic formulation, this literary or framework hypothesis. The second way this is articulated, and often they're both, if you read authors, they appeal to both sides of this, is they compare Genesis 1 to other creation accounts. Here the creation account is compared to other ancient Near Eastern creation accounts. And if you want to know how to spell ancient Near Eastern, just go down to letter A underneath it, and there are the words right there. Ancient Near Eastern creation accounts. By the way, if you read in a commentary, they might abbreviate that with capital A, capital N, capital E. A-N-E, ancient Near Eastern. So you'll see that a lot. And ancient Near Eastern just means, like, we're talking about the whole area from Mesopotamia, you know, modern day, like Iraq, Turkey, down to Israel, Egypt, that kind of region, right? Ancient Near Eastern. And the claim is that the form of Genesis 1 and 2 is similar to other ancient accounts, and that Moses, under inspiration, they would say, seeks to combat these false creation accounts with a superior one. Now, there are, in fact, many ancient Near Eastern accounts of creation that are written around the time of Genesis. Many of them involve various deities and their creation of the world through intrigue, and this is how they would describe this. Like, you read them, this is the kind of things that you'll see. There's intrigue with other deities that bring about the world, sexual acts with other deities or with created beings that bring about the universe, wars among the gods, and so on. That's how the world is created. So you can read them. Some common ones are the Enuma Elish, which is Mesopotamian in origin, as well as Egyptian accounts. The claim is that Genesis uses similar themes as these accounts, but paints God as greater than the other pagan accounts. Right? So here we have a story, the way the Babylonians, or actually better stated, ancient Mesopotamians, told how the creation of the world and the universe came about. You have Egyptian stories about how the world came about. Moses looks at that and says, I'm going to write a better story that reflects the kinds of things that God did that would speak to the culture of this day, but isn't actually trying to make any scientific claim whatsoever as to how the world was created. It's a story that reflects truth about what God is like and what God can do, but it's not actually trying to tell us any detail about how God created things. That makes sense? Well, hopefully it doesn't make sense to you on one level, all right? But are you following the argument there? And so, I note this here that here's one example, and I've actually brought up his book. This is Bruce Waltke. I've got a quote here. I'm going to read it and talk about him for a second. Here's the quote. I think it's in your notes. Finally, it was common belief in the ancient Near East that a high god defeated a primeval sea and created the world. But the God of Israel, instead of vanquishing monsters spawned by primordial abyss, created everything simply by his word without sexual intercourse, rivalry, battles, murders, and the like, and thereby showed his moral and spiritual supremacy to the pagan deities. So, Bruce Waltke. This is his Old Testament theology. This is probably the last major publication that he's going to give in his life. Bruce Waltke is known to every seminary student that's actually of a serious seminary in the United States. They all know him because if they take Hebrew, Bruce Waltke has written the definitive modern evangelical syntax of Hebrew. That's how to put together Hebrew language. He's written major commentaries. I have on my shelf several of them. Waltke, I think, for a long time was a Presbyterian, although these days he is, because of some of his views on evolution and theistic evolution, has now actually joined the Anglicans, my understanding. Waltke taught at Reformed Theological Seminary. Anybody know the name D. James Kennedy? Like, Kennedy was associated with that for many, many years. I mean, Kennedy's not with the Lord. Today, Kevin DeYoung is at RTS, Ligon Duncan. These are major evangelical figures and leaders. Waltke was kind of forced out of there in 2010 because of some of his more progressive views on evolution. But he's still a respected scholar among evangelicals. And he has a lot of really helpful things to say. I've read, you can see how far I've read into this Old Testament theology. I've not read the whole thing. It sits on my shelf, and you know, I can say, look, I've read some of it, but not all of it, about the first 120 pages. Some of which I read intentionally to deal, understand people who believe this very idea. All right? So Bruce Waltke, very influential. By the way, for those of you, like, some of this doesn't make any sense to some of you. Others, you'll make sense of it. Waltke grew up in a conservative Christian home. He's a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary. Got his PhD from there. Or THD, excuse me, later PhD, I think, from Cambridge. So he was, for a long time, in very much circles like ours. I do believe he's born again. I do believe that we will see him in heaven. But he is a very influential teacher that teaches this very thing. And he does it in his commentaries and articles, and there are dozens and dozens of major evangelical figures who hold this view and propagate it today. So it's the most common today. I also noted, I think at the beginning of this, the name Brevard Childs. So he's not so much an evangelical, but his views have also influenced the evangelical world in a great way. So this is a common idea, all right? Now, there are, however, we note here, letter C, there are significant problems with both explanations of the framework theory, both the artistic and the literary comparisons. And I want to talk about them, and then our time will be done. When it comes to the artistic formulation, while it is possible that there is a parallel triad in the 6 days, this does not indicate one way or another as to how God created the earth. In other words, it's quite possible that God intended to show symmetry and balance in the creation of the earth in 6 days, but this does not demand that God did not literally create the universe in 6 days. In other words, if you go back to that chart where it shows, you know, day 1, 2, 3, day 4, 5, 6, and if you want to argue with me that God, in fact, did set up those two triads and it's beautiful in symmetry, would that surprise you at all that God may have created the world in that way? No. God's a God of order. God's God of beauty. If he had intended to form the earth and the universe and then fill it in that symmetrical way, I have no problem with that. Great. More evidence of the glory of God. But that's not what's being claimed. What's being claimed is, oh, because there's this supposed symmetry, therefore it's all poetic and it doesn't actually tell us anything about how God actually created. Right? And those are not the same things. So even if you want to argue that there's a parallel, it doesn't hold. But even still, letter B, it's not certain that the parallel holds. Not certain that the parallel holds. Here's just one example. God speaks of the seas on day 3, and the fish fill the sea in Genesis 1:26 and 1:28. We would expect that if the parallel held, the seas would be created on day 2 and not 3. Because on day 2, you have the dividing of the waters. That's when you have that going on. Furthermore, Genesis has the creation of seas on day 3, but nothing fills the seas on day 6. In other words, the parallels are kind of stretched. And it's hard to see whether this actually holds. Now, the argument of poetry does not fit the kind of literature that Genesis 1 is. Right? So here's the poetic side. All right. So here's the first part is the artistic stuff. It's like, well, even if that's true, it doesn't mean that God didn't create this in six literal days. And second, I'm not sure the parallels work. But now we go to the poet, the comparison side of language, the kind of literature. In every language, you can tell the difference between poetry and historical narratives. All right. In every single language. In Hebrew, there are grammatical markers for this, and this will be the most technical thing I'll say of this whole day. One of them is the repeated use of vav consecutives. That is a technical Hebrew term. In Hebrew, the use of the vav consecutive with a preterite almost always indicates historical narrative, and there are over 50 of them in Genesis 1 and 2. What that means is that Moses did not write this as art or poetry. He wrote it as history. Now, what in the world does a vav consecutive mean? The simple way to understand a vav consecutive is to say something like this. Vav consecutives tell a narrative, not poetry. And it goes like this. And this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. So this morning, I stayed up very late last night, finishing up things for this morning. I slept in. I normally am up earlier than this on Sunday mornings. This morning, I slept in till 7:35. I actually had my alarm set for 7:45, but I woke up at 7:35. And I laid there in bed, and then my alarm went off at 7:45, and then I hit the snooze button and laid there in bed for a couple more minutes. And then I got up, and then I went in the shower. And then I got dressed, and then I came over here, and then I printed the bulletin, and then I printed these handouts, and then I met some of you, and then I prayed with Pastor Greg, right? Yeah, all right. And then I came here, and now I'm teaching. Now that's a narrative. Then I did this, then I did this, then I did this, then I did this. There's very clear markers. Now, sometimes in English, those markers are not "and then I." But when you read through an account in English, just like you read through an account in Hebrew, you can tell very quickly whether something is poetry or whether something is a narrative. And in this case, it's very specifically a historical narrative. And if you just read through Genesis 1, does that read like poetry, even in English? No. And it doesn't in Hebrew either. All right, so it's not poetic. Now, furthermore, beyond this, when you get to the literary comparisons, these comparisons are very thin. They are often based upon a few similar words or ideas. So, I mentioned earlier the Enuma Elish. And I'm just saying this, if you go take a religions course in the Old Testament at a secular university, they're going to bring this up. Like, this will be taught. Okay? They're going to say, well, Genesis is... somebody want to grab me a paper towel because I just made a mess. Thanks, Matt. They're going to say that Genesis is opening accounts. They're just written like the common ways of expressing creation in that day. This will be good, thank you. And it'll be compared almost immediately to the Enuma Elish. All right, they'll compare it almost immediately to that. So you'll have a religions professor who's going to teach this. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the Enuma Elish. You, by the way, can go read it online for free. If you search it for it, Google it, you're going to find it does not look like anything like Genesis. It's just flat out weird. It's like a lot of the pagan descriptions of the creation of the world and how the gods and goddesses have all sorts of intrigue together. The Enuma Elish, when it actually gets to the part about its creation account, it was a Babylonian poem. It describes the intrigue among the pantheon of gods that resulted in the creation of the world. The basic plot line is that the goddess Tiamat, whom the gods despise, is defeated by Marduk. You might have heard that name before, Marduk, the great ancient Babylonian god. Or maybe you remember it as a kid from the cartoons, Marduk the dog, right? Anybody remember that? All right. So Marduk, he was a dog, right? Am I right on that?
Marmaduke.
Ah! Never mind. Shows my cultural insensitivities. All right. Never mind. That was not in my notes. I was just thinking on the fly. Never a good thing. Marduk, he proposes in the Enuma Elish a plan to overthrow Tiamat and the other gods in exchange for his being made the supreme god of all. They agree, and Marduk sets to work. After he slays Tiamat, he splits her body in half, and the language is like a shellfish, and creates from her body the firmament and the earth. He then orders the heavens with the moon and the sun and the other heavenly bodies, creating times and seasons as well on the earth. In each of the areas of his creation, he appoints a god to oversee it. He also makes man from a god who sided with Tiamat in the battle. He has this god slain, and from his blood creates mankind, whom he identifies as savage. Man was to be in the service of the gods. In the end, Marduk is enthroned as the supreme deity and is praised by all the gods. The similarities between the Enuma Elish and the creation account sound very strong, don't they? They don't. And you can read it. I'm summarizing pages of stuff here, okay, in it. Now, it's a great archaeological find. It tells us something about the ancient Babylonian mind in many ways. It helps us understand their pagan practices and how they saw the world as ordered. They viewed man as savage, all right, and must be controlled. You think about the Babylonians and their strong, authoritarian way of ruling over people. Kind of makes sense. But the reality is that the parallels are weak. Yet, Waltke, if you actually do that, he has like a half a page in a chart of showing supposed parallels between that and the creation account. Now, often what they use is they use a word that appears in one language that is like a Hebrew word that appears in another language and say, therefore, they must be talking about the same idea or a few vague concepts. But it just doesn't work. It does not work at all. In the end, what these people with the literary framework or literary hypothesis are doing is they're trying to find a way to accommodate supposedly modern views of science as to how the earth and the universe came to be, and to try to find a way to fit it in the Bible. And it's always a stretch to do that. So we'll talk next week about, which won't take us very long, the most simple way is to say, here's what Genesis says, how the world was created. Let's just believe what it says on its face value. All right. Question. I'm actually a little over time, but I will take, this was a mouthful today. Questions, yeah.
Just a thought on the Hebrew language, what percent of the Bible is poetry? And if you could guess. And then the other thing is, doesn't Hebrew lend itself to parallelism and poetry all the way through?
Okay, as far as percent of the whole Bible, it's around 30%. If you get to the Hebrew, I'd have to rethink that, and I don't know the percentage of Hebrew. I mean, you have things like Psalms are obvious, but huge portions of the prophets are also poetry as well. However, yes, Hebrew language lends itself to poetry very easily, but they also, like every language, have clear distinguishing marks when something is poetry and not historical narrative. That's the key. Like there are clear distinctions in the Hebrew mind.
Repetitive in thought, oftentimes.
In poetry?
Well, isn't that a form of poetry? The way the Bible will say something, and then you know, like, what is man, or the son of man? In other words, that's a form of poetry, which is saying the same thing, but at the same time, oftentimes saying something more.
Yeah, one of the distinguishing markers of Hebrew poetry, I think what you're getting at is called parallelism, that you have a thought that is either advanced or slightly contrasted or paralleled exactly. They don't use like rhyming schemes like we do in Hebrew poetry. It's more ideas and feelings that are evoked from stacking ideas on top of each other or against each other. That's just not the way historical narrative works. I'm just saying there's clear grammatical differences between the two.
The Bible speaks about prophets, and I realize we're not talking about exactly the same thing. When the Bible speaks about prophets, it says that if a person exhibits untruth in a particular area, they should be discounted out of hand. While I understand that we're not talking about prophets here, the issue that I run into is so much of our academic understanding comes from individuals who are supposedly very versed in certain areas. Unfortunately, if we give them a vast amount of credence in one area, but they're so woefully inadequate in other areas, I wonder just how much of it creeps across the board. And people going into college that might be otherwise ready to think rightly about certain things wind up completely off track because somebody who sounds like they know what they're talking about and does, in many ways, has swayed their opinion away from biblical truth.
It's a warning. That's why I wouldn't encourage just anybody to read Waltke's Old Testament theology. He's a really good writer. So, yep. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. We'll get ready for our morning worship service.